Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Gabe Odell, thank you for being on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. Great to be with you.
Now that brings us to you on your research and writing your books, like when you started. What first of all, The Black Dahlia, what brought you to writing about Black Dahlia? Was it your father or was it something else?
Yeah. Well, of course, I had heard, the only thing I knew about the Black Dahlia back then was that it was a famous unsolved murder case from the 40s. When I went through the police academy, they had photographs shown of the crime itself because it was such a famous, infamous, I guess, crime, L.A. crime. And but I didn't even know the victim's name, Elizabeth Short. All I knew, it was a famous cold case from the 40s. And I, as a young homicide detective, was interested in the 60s and the, you know, the present, not the past.
Yeah.
So I really knew nothing about it, and it came to me. So long after I retired, I was, 14 years into retirement, and my father's death, I flew down. And I'm sitting there with June, his widow, and she brings out a small book, a photo book album, and it's only like 3 by 5 inches. And she says, I think your father would want you to have this to belong to him. And I open it up, and I'm going through, and there are photographs, and they're photographs of us boys. They're photographs of my mother, a number of photographs by a photographer by the name of Man Ray. Are you familiar with who he was? He was a famous surrealist photographer and very close friend of my father's, and became quite famous, lived in Paris most of his life, and his stuff sang in the Getty and selling for a couple of $100,000. So he became quite famous in his later years. Back then, he was kind of just starting out and lived in Hollywood for 10 years and was very close to my father. He was our family photographer. Anyway, there were photographs of family members, my grandparents, and then I opened up and I came to a photograph of a nude woman reclining with her eyes closed. And I turned to June and I said, June, who's this? She says, I don't know, somebody your father knew from a long time ago. Well, it looked like, and to this day, I don't quite know why Black Dahlia came to my mind, but it did. And I think it was probably, they did it in 1975, they had a television movie called Who is the Black Dahlia? And Lucy Arnaz played the Dahlia. And the photograph looked exactly like that. So that might have been my source on that. But for whatever, and it just comes to, you know, kind of floats in and floats out, Black Dahlia, but I didn't think much of it. And then a couple of days later, I'm on the telephone to Tamar, my half-sister, George being both our the father to both of us.
Yeah.
She's in Hawaii, and she was the victim of the incest. And we're talking about the great man's passing and what a remarkable life he led and stuff. And out of the blue, she says, well, you know, Steve, he was suspected of being the Black Dahlia. And I said, what are you talking about, Tamar? I said, what? Well, we had only had maybe 15 minutes of conversation in 50 years.
Yeah.
So you know, she after she was sexualized and the trial and all of that, she kind of spun out of control and got into drug, sex, rock and roll, San Francisco, kind of the original Mother Earth hippie.
Yeah.
And all of that. So we had very little contact. She would occasionally call me when she, you know, maybe she was arrested for possession of marijuana, she needed some bail or something. But other than that, I just had no contact with her. So we're talking, and she says this, and I said, where is this coming from, Tamar? She says, well, that's what the police told me when I was, you know, in detention. They taking me to and from court on the incest trial. They said that we think that your father, telling her, we think your father was the Black Dahlia suspect, and they have a lot of reasons for it. So I'm thinking, no, there's no way. I said, you know, I, for whatever reason, as I had mentioned, I was probably thought I knew my father better than anyone. I was closest to him and had more contact with him than any of his other children. And I was aware of his, you know, sexual obsession and some of his other eccentricities, but killer? No way. You know, he couldn't have done that. So that was the second kind of blinking red light, was what Tamar said. So I start looking into the case, and I find out her name's Elizabeth Short, and I start getting the details, and I'm divorced at that time, and my girlfriend's in L.A., and I'm having her send me up all of the newspaper clippings and articles from the five different newspapers in L.A. on the original case. And there's a massive amount of material. So she's sending me up, and one of the articles she sends me is, I look at the front page of a newspaper, and it's, well, what happened was the killer, and we probably need to get into a little description of what happened on the Dahlia, but after the killing, the killer started sending in written messages taunting the police, catch me if you can, I'm going to Mexico, I'll give myself up for $20,000, all sorts of kind of disguised writing, cut and paste notes like ransom notes, that sort of thing.
Hmm.
And one of these said, turning myself in on January 29th, had my fun at the police, and he signs it Black Dahlia Avenger. And this, of all of them, this is the only one that's undisguised handwriting. And I look at it, this is my father's handwriting. And I mean, you know your parents' handwriting, your listeners know their parents' handwriting, and I know my father's. And I said, wait a minute, this can't be. There's got to be some other explanation here. And I said, maybe, is he pretending to be? What's going on here?
Yeah.
And I do more research, heard research, and I discover that the killer was a surgeon, that the body was expertly bisected at the waist, in a special procedure that was taught in medical schools in the 30s called a hemicorpectomy. This wasn't a butcher or, this was a skilled surgeon, and LAPD believed that a doctor had done it. So that was another blinking red light. And I thought, oh, yes. I said, there's no way. Well, I'll be able to show that he had nothing to do with this. So at that point, I realized I need to relocate back to L.A., and, you know, I can't do an absentee investigation on this. So I relocated back to L.A. in 2000 or 2001, and I would start my investigation. I would do interviews. I would do contacts with all sorts of individuals. ultimately, we just don't have time to go through all the details, but basically I was able to develop a strong case. I went in secret to the district attorney's office, presented it with the photo exhibits, and I had handwriting analysis done by a handwriting expert and confirmed that the handwriting was, in fact, George Hodel's, independent of my own identification. And, you know, basically what I was doing was, you know, it was a two-pronged investigation into the mysterious life of my father that I knew little about, and also into his potential connection to the murder itself. As I proceeded, I discovered that LAPD believed that there were a number of murders from the beginning of the 1940s to 1950, about 9 or 10, the L.A. lone woman murders, and they were, LAPD believed that many of them were connected to each other, at least 4 or 5 they listed. Well, by the time I was through, I felt 9 or 10 were connected. So I present this in secret my findings to the DA. He reviews it for a couple of months, comes back and says, you know, based on your investigation, he says, I would file 2 counts of murder against your father were he still alive. I would file the Black Dahlia Elizabeth Short murder, and I would file a second murder, which was known as the lipstick murder, where the killer actually wrote a lipstick message on the body itself, on the nude body. Posed it in a vacant lot, just like he had the Dahlia. He says, the others are interesting. He says, but not quite enough for a filing. He says, but based on your investigation, I would file, and I believe I could easily win it with a jury. So with that, I decided, okay, I'll go public, and I'll write this up and reveal it to the public. I had attempted to meet with LAPD for the 6 months prior to sit down and lay it all out to them, and they kept putting me off and putting the DA and I off together and saying, you know, we don't have time for this. So ultimately, we ran out of time. The book came out, and it was very controversial. A lot of press on it. You know, Dateline did a 48 hours. Dateline did a piece on it. 48 hours did a piece. And there have been about 6 or 8 different hour shows on my investigation. And so that was in 2003 when the first version came out. Well, what happened then was it blasted open the secret DA files. And what happened was Steve Lopez of the LA Times, I had given him a kind of a heads up on this and saying, you know, this will be coming out. And because he was a watchdog kind of guy, and I thought he would be a good guy to go to. So he goes to the DA and says, hey, there's this Hodel. He says his father is a Black Dahlia killer, all of this stuff. And the DA says, well, I'm not spending a dime of county money on this, but he says, there is a box in the vault on the Dahlia if you want to take a look at that. Lopez says, I'd love to. So he gives him this box, which the DA has never looked at. And Lopez carries it upstairs, sits in the room, opens up the box, takes out a file, and out falls a photograph of Dr. George Hill Hodel. Now, this file has been locked away for 55 years. Nobody's seen it since 1950. And he says, whoa, so he was a suspect. And he goes through, and what does he discover? He discovers that not only was he a suspect, he was the prime suspect, and that L.A. and the DA's investigators back in 1950, 3 years after the murder, went out to picked George Hodel up, took him into the Hall of Justice for questioning. And while he was there, they broke into this Mayan temple we were still living in Hollywood, and bugged it. They basically put hard microphones in the walls and in the living room and in the bedroom, and ran hard wires, connected them to the Pacific telephone lines, ran that to Hollywood Police Station 2 miles away, set up a recorder, and listened 24/7 for the next 42 2 days, tape recorded all the conversations. This isn't a phone bug. This is actual hard live conversations. And as a result of that, they got a lot of Dad statements and admissions and confessions from Dad. We don't have to go through all of them, but basically, they also suspected him a year and a half before that murder of overdosing his secretary, a woman by the name of Ruth Spaulding. Mm. And he was investigated on that as a probable murder investigation. It was listed ultimately as a suicide. They couldn't prove that he did the forced overdose on her of pills. They were having an affair, and apparently she was going to reveal some information she had learned about George. Now, this is prior to the Dahlia murder, so it was either one of the other murders, earlier murders, or the fact that he was performing abortions, which came out in the secret tape recordings, or who knows, it could have been one of anything. Anyway, she overdosed, and he took her into the hospital. She was comatose. She died 20 minutes later. So there were a lot of admissions he made. One of them was that were tape recorded. He said, supposing I did kill the Black Dahlia, they can't prove it now. My secretary's dead, which referred to Ruth Spaulding, who probably could have identified him as knowing and been acquainted with Elizabeth Short, the Black Dahlia. The police reports verify that he did know Elizabeth Short, that they were having an affair, or at least were acquainted prior to her death. And there's a whole massive amount of he talks about performing abortions. He talks about the actual killing of Ruth Spaulding. Describes taking her to the hospital. He describes putting a pillow over her head. And he says, I think the police may have found out about it. I think they figured it out. And he goes on and on with all sorts of incriminating statements. So he's about to be arrested by LAPD and the DA's investigators in 1950, in March, and suddenly he takes off. He's probably warned by one of his insiders. Takes off and leaves the country, splits, and literally leaving the DA's investigators with their microphones up the wall.
Yeah.
so they pull out, and anyway, all very damning because, you know, Steve O'Dell could talk for 20 hours about all of the evidence and connections, but it's still Steve O'Dell saying it. So but here you have independent confirmation by official police reports that he was the prime suspect and he confessed to it. So, and they had these were actually transcripts they had of the tape recordings. So that obviously, you know, and that came out in a later updated chapter in my book, and I built on that, and then new witnesses came forward that indicated that they knew all along that he was the killer, and just at this point we're way beyond any reasonable doubt in regards to him being the Black Dahlia killer and probably the other 8 or 9 murders. So what you've got is a serial killer in Los Angeles operating for 10 years.
Her murder and the other ones that you sort of associated with it, was there a common bond, as in like, so if George O'Dell did it, like, you know, a lot of serial killers or chain killers had the same, like they wanted a certain type of girl or certain look, certain hair, certain
right.
size.
Yeah.
Was there any of that with these, or was it just random?
Well, that's a good question. But, you know, it's what I call the CSI effect. A lot of people say, well, but one was blonde and one was brunette, so it couldn't be the same suspect. Or they say one was young and one was old, or he never, you know. It's ridiculous, especially in George O'Dell's case. He was all over the radar screen in regards to his MO and his signatures, but there were some common links, and probably one of the strongest was that of the 9 murders I talk about, 6 of them, the killer wrote a taunting message either on the victim's property or mailed it to the police, leaving messages when he wrote on a body. And all you know, this unique handwriting, hand printing. Many of the victims, many of these messages were identified as being written by George Odell by my handwriting expert. So that's very unusual. I mean, I have never had, in the 300 cases I investigated, I never had one where they actually wrote a message or a note. So that's a very unique MO or signature. You've got it on six of them. The thing to understand about, and this carries through to the later crimes in the San Francisco Bay Area and other locales, he was an urban terrorist. So his MO, his real motive for the crimes was basically to hold a city hostage, and scare a city. Dad was ultimately, I would discover, not only was he a misogynist who hated women, but he was a misanthrope. He hated humanity. And his way of it was to get page, what he demanded to be above the fold on page one in the newspapers. And he did it in Los Angeles and managed to stay above the fold for many of his crimes. He did it in the San Francisco Bay Area as Zodiac. And he did it in Chicago, three crimes in Chicago, which I also go into in the sequel. So basically, you can't use a textbook on George Odell. He was, even though there's a massive amount, when I get into the Zodiac crimes, I actually list 31 major MO signatures that are identical between Black Dahlia Avenger, George Odell, and Zodiac. Very unique, very distinct. If you get two or three of these, you begin to look at it as possibly connected, but 31 is just, unbelievable.
Right.
Anyway, so that, to answer your question, it's not the victim type that's common, it's other actions he did, and there's a whole theme that we probably don't have time to get into, which is his whole theme on all of this was, and I go into it in detail, is murder, what I call murder is a fine art. He's taking items from literature, he's taking music in his crimes, he's using art, literature, film, and he's tying them all into his killings, incorporating them, and it's mind-boggling. I'll give you one example to start with. In Los Angeles, one of the earlier pre-Dahlia murders, there's a radio show, and it's in July of 1943, and it's called The White Rose Murder, and they had suspense theater. I don't know if you're familiar with
that. Oh, yeah, yeah.
The old-time radio show.
Oh, yeah, that's...
Maureen O'Hara was a young, just starting out as a young star, and she played the lead in this... There was a story by Woolrich, Cornell Woolrich. It's called The White Rose Murders. And they did this radio play on air. I think it was a 30-minute. And the story was about a killer, a serial killer, who killed four or five times. He goes to a dance hall. He picks up a woman, takes her out, kills her, leaves a white rose by the body. And he does this to four or five different victims. Well, 2 weeks after that aired, George Odell goes to a ballroom a block from his office, medical office downtown L.A., and meets a woman, invites her to dances with her, charms her. Now, this is a very debonair, young, handsome man, young doctor, and invites her to Hollywood to show her the scenes. Takes her to a isolated golf course, strangles and beats her to death, leaves a white gardenia by the body. Now, this is 2 weeks after the airing of this show, and he's following the script almost line by line. And that's kind of gives you what I did. And he doesn't do this just in radio, but he does it in all the arts. And there's probably a dozen or 15 different ones that he's taken. He's taken from four or five different films, is just remarkable. There's never ever been quite an MO quite like it.
So he was pretty serious. He did his job well.
Yeah.
So what was it about Black Dahlia that sticks out? Like before all of this and your father, why were they still showing pictures like when you were in the police academy, and why was it still something that held the attention of not only the public but the police and other people years after? Like, is there something that you've figured out to, like, what, I guess it's that same old question of why do certain crimes stay with?
Well, yeah, there are a couple of reasons that I come up with on that. First of all, it's the it got a massive amount back in 1947. It got a massive amount of publicity. It was literally headlines for 40 days, and it went nationwide, but of course heavily covered here in Los Angeles by the five or six newspapers of the day. They were vying to outscoop each other on the story, and you've got a beautiful young woman. You've got the name Black Dahlia. Now that the source of that was actually, there was a movie called The Blue Dahlia that came out that summer, and it was with Alan Ladd and Veronica Lake. And it was a noir film that came out. Yeah. So the soldiers, she used to hang out at a soda fountain down in Long Beach, Elizabeth, while she was out here. And she would go in there, and the guys in there would actually call her the Black Dahlia, kind of a spin-off of this movie from Blue Dahlia, even though the Blue Dahlia is actually a bar, not a person. But anyway, they gave her this name, and one of the news guys called the pharmacy and got this information. And came, and so you've got this mysterious Black Dahlia, you've got a young, beautiful woman, and then you've got this absolute horror of being, one of the things that made the crime so distinct was the absolute horror inflicted on her. It was a torture murder. Experts estimate it probably took from 4 to 5 hours to complete. I won't go into all the details because it's just too gruesome, but basically cuttings around the body. The breast was, one of the breasts was removed. Pieces of flesh were cut and inserted in her privates. She was bound and tied. There were ligature marks on her feet and her hands and her neck. She was sexually molested. Slow torture. There were cuttings over the body. The mouth was slashed. Actually, it wasn't slashed. That's kind of a misrepresentation. It was cut from almost ear to ear with a scalpel. And then it was washed clean, surgically bisected. The procedure is called a hemicorpectomy, and you have to go between the second and third lumbar vertebrae. It's the only way you can divide a body without sawing through bone. So they knew it was a skilled surgeon that did it and that was aware of this. The body was washed clean. It was carefully posed in a vacant lot 5 miles south of Hollywood. So all of these things came together. Of course, the veteran homicide detectives had never seen anything quite like it, and they were shocked.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information, information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And stunned. And the newspaper coverage, the name, and it's just kind of all everything there to make a legend, you know.
Yeah.
And it was all of this mystery and stuff. In fact, a lot of my opposition, they don't want it solved. In other words, they believe that the mystery is what it's all about. And if you solve it, it's no longer, doesn't have the same allure, I guess you could say. So a lot of my opposition said, you know, we don't want this solved. Don't mess with our myth, you know.
Yeah.
And so I think it was basically, and it was also, the other factor is that it was the last big print story before television. In other words, television was just coming in, and this was kind of like the last really big story to come out just before that. So all of these factors came together, I think, to make it what it was. And then, of course, hack writers jumped on that and have been promoting it. Some of the horrific photographs were put in books and for everybody to see just how much horror, you know. So they sensationalized it.
Are there any others out there? Like, have you read or saw any movies or documentaries or anything out there that you sort of think are good work or good representation of Dahlia and sort of the situation?
I guess the short answer is no.
No.
Ironically, you know, the real story, the real truth of this case is much more, in a way, sensational, much more bizarre than any story you could, you know, than any of these other stories that have been put out there. You couldn't think this story up. You know, the son of the killer grows up to become a homicide detective and solves the case. I mean, the mind wouldn't even go there if you walked into a studio with this as a script. They'd say, get the hell out of here. You know, it's too bizarre. But there it is. And there's really no longer, I'm running about 90 to 95%, you know, for conviction. I mean, I've proved it beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, you know, it kept building on itself. And now with the second volume coming out and all of the evidence, the new evidence that we've turned up, I've actually been able to do establish items from the Hodel residence found at the crime scene. I mean, I don't know if you're aware of the cement sacks, but I was actually able to link some 50-pound cement sacks that were established at being at the Franklin House the week, so-called missing week in January of 47, that were used to transport the body to the crime scene and were left next to the body, and LAPD confirms that these were used to transport from an unknown residence. I've actually been able to connect those through original receipts to the house. So that's physical, hard physical evidence. We've cadaver dog has come back positive on human remains, the detected human remains at the from soil samples at the Franklin House. And these have been analyzed and confirmed that they're specific for human remains as opposed to anything else. So it just goes on and on. We just don't have time to to document all of the new evidence, too. So I guess one of the points I'm trying to make is that going into the, you know, and from the conclusion of that investigation on the Dahlia and the other L.A. lone woman murders, I was pulled in from the police reports, actually pulled me into the possibility that George O'Dell could have reinvented himself as Zodiac in the 60s and started up the same M.O. and the same signatures and stuff. And I wouldn't have even gone there except that the police reports actually have Elizabeth Short investigating Dad in Chicago for some crimes. And that started me off on that and took me into another huge rabbit hole, which ultimately became Most Evil, and now the second book, Most Evil 2, which, you know, basically connect him, in fact, as in Most Evil 1, the first book I came out with, Dutton, in 2009, I made a compelling case that George O'Dell was Zodiac, but I didn't say case solved. I said, let's do some DNA, let's take a look at this and see, you know, let's get a rule in or rule him out on DNA. Well, they still haven't developed DNA, but confirmed DNA. But anyway, I kept moving, and I said, you know, right now I'm saying, you know, it's a possibility. It's a strong possibility, but I'm not saying the case is solved.
Right.
So the last 5 years, I've continued working on it, and now I am, with a book that came out last week, Most Evil 2, I am saying yes, and we have, and I'm offering the reasons and the proofs. And believe me, my reputation is on the line. I would not come out and say that he is Zodiac unless I felt I had absolutely made the case, and that's what I've done in the new book.
Well, Zodiac's a pretty hot subject. I know just with some of the other books out, and I did quite a few interviews in 1 month, huge response to it, and there's still quite a bit of talk about this. So how has that community reacted to you or your book? Do you think that they're sort of not...
Well, they haven't... First of all, they're not aware of the new... It's just out. So the book, my new book, was embargoed. So it just came out last week. So I don't think hardly anybody has even read it yet. So they don't know what is coming. But basically, I'm offering a signed confession by Zodiac in one of the original things. I've decrypted, actually, I didn't do it, a Frenchman did it and contacted me, and we worked together on it. But basically have decrypted one of the original Zodiac ciphers, and it's a signed confession by George O'Dell actually admitting to the crime, signing his own name. I mean, this is like, I can't believe that he would actually do this. You know, I mean, how stupid. But it was one of his weaknesses, you know. I mean, his hubris was his ultimate undoing. You know, he was a megalomaniac, and he concealed this in a cryptic language that he thought nobody would ever break the code.
Right.
And this Frenchman has done it, and it leaves no doubt. I mean, you know, he's signed his name and for all to see, and the document is genuine. So, you know, my critics are going to have a tough time with this one because, you know, there are five letters, and those letters are H-O-D-E-L, and I don't know what they're going to be able to do with that. But the point is that that's only part of it. I mean, that's what I call the Rosetta Stone. You know, that's the kind of, in a way, you could say as an investigator, it's the icing on the cake. But there's a whole lot more to the connection of George O'Dell to Zodiac than meets the eye. And again, a lot of it has to do with deconstructing myths, one of them being the biggest hurdle I had was, for myself to start out, was there's no way. I started out by saying there's no way that George O'Dell could be Zodiac because he was a much younger man. Well, guess what? Once I got into the weeds of it, I discovered and got the original police reports and stuff, and so suddenly that age discrepancy disappeared. Originally, well, even in the original bulletin, they had him 35 to 45. And the most reliable, the best witness of all of them, actually was the police officer, Donald Fuchs, who actually saw him leaving the scene of the San Francisco cabby murder, Paul Stein. And he's the one that said, and he comes out and says, well, actually, it was at the high end of that. He was more like 45.
Yeah.
Well, if you talk to a witness and he's giving you a scan like that as an investigator, I would say, well, could he have been 47, 48, 49? He's going to say, yeah, he could have been. You know. So you've got that. And then you've got George O'Dell, who was actually 60, but he looked, you know, he could easily pass for mid to late 40s. So suddenly that, you know, that makes that possible as far as the physical and everything else fits. The shoe size is the same shoe size, on and on. And suddenly your description, you know, most people just dismissed it saying he was too old. But in fact, he wasn't too old at all. He looked young, much younger than he was, and the suspect was, in fact, in his late 40s. A couple more composites came out of Zodiac by a couple of artists who make him actually look in his early 50s. And they're, I don't know if you've seen it, but they're almost picture perfect to George O'Dell, including the glasses. Anyway, so you've got the physical, but that's, again, you know, just that puts it in the ballpark. So,
yeah.
And ultimately, in my first book, Most Evil, I present probably the most compelling evidence is, again, this game playing where Zodiac sends in maps to the police and the press and says, you know, it has to do with radians and inches along the on the map and stuff. And he's basically tells and instructs them. He says, align the position, the compass to true north. And so he's instructing. Well, I follow his instructions, and basically we come up with the circle, the one line going through his killings in the Napa area, in Vallejo, and the other line of this 60-degree radian, 58-degree radian, goes directly through the killings in the Presidio, the Paul Stein cabbie, and also directly over the grave of, guess who, Elizabeth Short, the Black Dahlia, who's buried in Oakland, California, at Mountain View Cemetery in Oakland. The line goes directly over her grave. And so there's, you know, there's a whole bunch of, then he connects, the Zodiac is connecting his to the Mikado. And Dad was an expert in the Mikado. He was a radio announcer on classical music and Gilbert and Sullivan, and it just goes on and on, too many points.
Yeah.
Here's the bottom line in regards to Zodiac. Going into my investigation, we've got the Black Dahlia Avenger, who's a serial killer in Los Angeles, who's sending in notes, taunting the police, handwriting, and all of this. We're starting out with a serial killer that's doing all of the same things that Zodiac is doing 20 years later. And it's, you know, handwriting, I include a whole chapter of all the samples of my father's handwriting, and have been, many of the notes of Zodiac notes have been confirmed by my expert. I'm not personally really big on handwriting. I have a problem with it. I think it's too subjective.
Right.
You get experts to say, yes, this is definitely him, and this other experts say, no, it's definitely not him. Well, that's not science to me.
Yeah.
Science is, you know, you don't get both answers in science. So I have a real problem with it. It's okay to use it as long as, you know, you have all of your other evidence to go with it. But to use just handwriting for guilt or innocence, no way. You just can't do that.
What do you think, then? I was just going to say, but so if you think he did, you know, like the Dahlia and the Shane murders, and then he's up to doing Zodiac, what happened in the in-between times? Because it's not typical for someone that has an affinity to murder like this to just stop.
It certainly isn't. So you're absolutely right, and he didn't. And one of the crimes that I document in Most Evil 1, the first book, is a crime that another part of my father's unusual M.O. and this, again, this murder is a fine art and playing games. I start off my earlier book, Most Evil, with three crimes that I believe he committed in Chicago in the 40s, before the Dahlia murder. They were known as the lipstick murders, very famous. And there was a young 6-year-old girl by the name of Suzanne, and two adult women, who were bathtub murders. And these three crimes were supposedly solved by a young teenager who supposedly confessed to him and was sent speedily to prison, a guy named Bill Hirons, a very famous case. So I didn't really look at these because I figured, well, the case is solved, no need to. But then I discover in the police reports that Elizabeth Short goes back to Chicago, begins investigating these three lipstick murders on her own. This is all documented in the police reports. This isn't something I'm making up. And actually sleeps with a number of the newsmen to get information on the killings, and they admit to it that they were with her and that she was back there investigating these crimes, these three crimes. I'm thinking, what's going on here? Well, at the same time she's doing that, Dad is temporarily away in China. He's over there for supposedly a year, and while she's investigating these crimes. And I think what happened was that she communicated, wrote a letter, or said something, or maybe he came back on leave, I'm not sure. Anyway, said something to Dad, you know, you didn't do the murders in Chicago, did you, jokingly or whatever. Anyway, the next thing we know is she starts running in fear of her life. And Dad unexpectedly comes back from China, quits his job over there with the United Nations, comes back. She starts fleeing, and within a month she's dead. Now, I believe that she found out or discovered something in regards that connected him. But here's the kicker. Her body, so she's tortured, she's basically bisected and taken and posed on this lot. And the street that she's posed off of, the killer, I believe Dad, posed it, and the name of the street that he thought he was on was Degnan. Degnan, because you come up Degnan and it forks off, and if you go to the right, you're still on Degnan. If you go to the left, you're on the, you're on another street that with a vacant lot. I'm blanking on the name right now. I can't believe I don't. Anyway, he thought he was on Degnan. He poses the body there. Well, what's the name of the little girl in Chicago that was murdered? Degnan. Well, I've never even heard of that name. Anyway, so that's another one of his taunting clues he poses. So you're going to investigate me on Degnan? Okay. So he poses the body off the street, which he thinks is Degnan. Okay, fast forward. The next crime we've got to answer your question now, is in Manila. Young woman. Her body's nude, bisected, surgically bisected by a skilled surgeon, posed on a vacant lot, 8 blocks from my father's house, on a street. It's called, becomes one of their most famous unsolved, called the Jigsaw Murder. What's the name of the street that body's posed on? Zodiac. And I said, no way. You know, there's no way that this can be. So that's what pointed me. And the Manila killing is, you know, it was a surgeon. It was a, there's no question about it. And it's a copycat Dahlia murder that occurred in 67. Okay. So you're right. I mean, he did keep on killing. We have the Riverside murder in 66 of Sherry Jo Bates, which is Zodiac connected, in 67. And then we come back in 68. The murders start in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area. And again, there's the connections to the map and all of this. It all fits into this very twisted. This was part of his insanity. and it gets into surrealism. The surrealists believe that there was no difference between the dream and the waking state, and they played at it intellectually. Dad really believed it. In other words, he believed that there was no difference between a dream and an action you do as, you know, with your own volition. So you can kill, you can do anything you want. There is no God. There is nothing to stop you from doing all of this. And that was his personal insanity. And where the others intellectualized it and played with it, he actually walked the walk and did it. I mean, yeah. He actually went out there and did it. And that's what makes him one of the most, I mean, I have, by the end of this book, I've presented 25 different murders that I believe are that he was responsible from basically 1940 to 1970. So almost one a year, averaging one a year.
How did that change your relationship with him now? As in, so you've lived and he's passed on, but now that you've done this research and are pretty confirmed about his murder past, has it changed the way you felt about him now?
Well, I've been through every possible emotion in the last 14 years. I've been through every possible emotion you can imagine. And, you know, I loved my father. I loved him and I respected him. And, you know, I went through various emotions when I looked at all of the absolute horror and how it's affected so many lives. You know, it's not just the victims, but it's their family members. I mean, not knowing, and the, you know, literally hundreds and hundreds of people have been affected by this his carnage. You know, I think I've come to the position where I see him as a Jekyll and Hyde. You know, that's an easy thing to say, but I think he actually really was. Because in many of the notes, and this is interesting because it links him to all of the different crimes. In Los Angeles, he writes a note promising there will be more. Chicago, he writes a note, there will be more. In Riverside, he writes a note, there will be more. And in San Francisco, in Zodiac, he says there will be more killings. So that's a huge connection there, just in his voice. And I see that's the Mr. Hyde inside of him. The monster that's the stronger. And I think the Dr. Jekyll, the good part, who could have, you know, done so much with his talents, was the weaker and was controlled, and we see this in many of his writings, especially his Zodiac. So, you know, I love my father. I love him to this day. I mean, he created me. His blood is flowing through me.
Right.
My gene pool is him. So there's a part of me that is never going to stop being able to love my father, even though he was probably one of the world's most horrific misogynists and misanthropes that's ever walked the planet. And I hate the monster inside of him, the Mr. Hyde. But so I guess you could say I'm kind of emotionally bisected, just as Elizabeth was physically bisected. You know, and there's nothing I'll ever be able to do to mend that or do anything about it.
Yeah, I was just thinking that it must have been kind of weird to look back at times when you were hanging out and being with him, like in the times of San Francisco in the last 10 years. Do you think he continued murdering then?
No. I suspect, I mean, I don't know for sure, but I suspect that probably the 1970 murder was probably his last. The Paul Stein murder in 69, the cab driver. You know, I don't know for sure, but he was, you know, I mean, you get to a point where you're too old. I mean, he was 91 when he died.
Yeah.
He was, you know, at some point you just, and he had a lot of problems in the last few years of his life. He was in a lot of pain. He was having a lot of problems with osteoporosis. He could hardly walk. He needed assistance. So, but he was white hot up until through his 70s. So actually even further, because he was fine, you know, up until the last 5 years before his death. So, but you know, I could be wrong, but I don't think he killed after 1969 or 70. He had June with him at that point, and they were married 30 years, and she was a tremendous positive influence on his life. She loved him very much, and I think she probably, helps him control the beast inside, so to speak. And I think he just burned up. That part just burned out eventually, you know.
Yeah. That's, wow. So that's quite a story and quite a life. Now your new book has just come out, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, it was embargoed, and as I say, it's a quick read. What I do is I include a lot of addendum in there, also in addition to the 10 chapters. But the key chapter, of course, is chapter 10, which is the decryption of Zodiac's cipher. And it's not one of the, you're probably familiar with the cryptograms,
yeah,
with the wording and stuff. It's not that. That's, you can play with that and come up with just about any name you want. A number of authors have, said, hey, there's the name, and, so it's not that at all. It's something else that Zodiac wrote that was much more subtle and much more disguised. And but it leaves no doubt. I mean, it's, believe me, I have a reputation at stake, and I wouldn't put it online unless it was there. So,
you're expecting some backlash here, because the Zodiac people are very aggressive, and I know that, like, Grace Smith had, was behind the movie and the books, Thomas Horan, there's all those people. So, what are you ready for it?
Well, I don't get in pissing contests with other theorists and stuff. They can present theirs, I present mine. Basically, my judge and jury are my readers, and you're not going to convince. They've already got their minds made up on it, either a certain suspect or whatever. So you're not going to change minds like that. They're going to have a hard time coming up with. I mean, I tried to come up with an alternate explanation for this. I'm pretty good at it, but I haven't been able to yet. But I'm sure that you're right. That some naysayer will say, "Well, here's another explanation."
Oh yeah,
but
yeah.
And you can't take it, you can't just take it on that one. You have to take the whole picture. The 31 signatures alone is very damning. I mean, we're talking about things as unique and special as, Avenger draws a crude drawing, the Black Eye Avenger in the 40s draws a crude drawing of a knife gripping blood and mails it to the press. Zodiac draws a crude drawing of a knife dripping blood and mails it to the press. And, things like that wait a minute, Avenger takes pre-cut clothesline lengths with him on his crimes to use. Zodiac takes pre-cut clothesline with him on his crimes to use. Cut and pasted mailings, the voice, the taunting voice is the same. It just goes on and on, so I'm not just using general, general MO. I'm using very specifics.
I appreciate the work you're doing, and we're glad, and wish you the best, and hope to have you again.
Okay, Alan, thank you very much. It's been good talking with you.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.